Welcome to the Well Podcast. We hope that this message will help you grow in your faith and give you practical ways to strengthen your relationships. To find out more, visit thewell.ca.
Now, I was in my last year of high school. There was an older lady at my church who one day kind of took me aside and said she wanted to talk to me. And so she said to me that she wanted to just encourage me to think about considering maybe after university going to school to become a pastor. I kind of smiled, and I didn't know her very well. I smiled and nodded politely, but on my inside voice, I was like, are you kidding me? There's absolutely no way, no chance that I would ever do that. And there's probably a couple reasons for this. Biggest reason is that really my faith at that point in my life didn't really mean very much to me at all. I can actually remember having that thought many times that, like, when I was old enough to decide for myself, when I moved out, when I was on my own, and I had the choice not to just go with my family, but to go on my own to church or not, there was no way I was going to choose to go regularly to church on any level. But the other reason for that, which is probably just as big, is that there was a lot about church that I just didn't relate to at all. Like, I was an 18-year-old teenager. And frankly, I just kind of associated church with a lot of old stodginess, at least the church that I was a part of. There was a lot of, in my 18-year-old mind, there was a lot of old stodgy people, for one. There was a lot of people who were a lot older than me and who were not close to my age, and so I couldn't relate to people that way. There was a lot of old stodgy songs that were sung and sung like in kind of old stodgy ways. There was a big old stodgy pipe organ, like it was that kind of church, big old stone church, big old pipe organ. There was an old stodgy preacher who kind of I couldn't relate to, and a lot of the things that he said, there just wasn't very much about all of this stuff that was actually very compelling or attractive to me on any level. Do you think that one day I'm going to go to school to become a pastor? Not a chance. Well, then I went away to university. And for a lot of people, at least people who grew up in church, for a lot of people, those university years are actually kind of a time of life where maybe they step away from faith or walk away from faith. They leave faith behind in their life. For me, it was actually the opposite. It was actually a time in my life where I found faith in Jesus. And a big reason for that is actually because I discovered this amazing community of people, of actually Jesus-following students, people on my age on campus that I kind of became a part of. And through that, my faith literally, like, it skyrocketed. These were people that were just a lot of fun to be around. Like, again, my age, I could relate to them in a lot of ways. So we spent a lot of time together. We had a lot of fun together. We did a lot of things together. We laughed a lot together. But more than that, they weren't just people my age and who I could relate to and spend time with. They were people who were genuinely passionate about Jesus. Like, I still remember, like, clear as day, it's almost like 25-30 years ago, the first time walking into the church on campus and seeing the pews filled with other students, other people my age, who were singing songs that I could relate to and songs that it actually seemed like they cared about what they were singing. That was mind-blowing to me. And not just that, but as I got to know many of these people, I realized that, wow, like, these people are kind of different. Like, they live differently than any other group of people that I had connected with before. More than that, they were people that, like, prayed when they hung out at times. Sometimes they even got early so they could meet together to pray. It was crazy. These were people that read the Bible because they wanted to. They actually knew what was in the Bible, and they believed that it mattered. These were people that genuinely wanted to know and grow in Jesus, and they wanted that for others too, and there was something about that that was so compelling for me. Not just that. All of these people, I remember one of the things noticing about this group was that they were just all so different from each other. Like, up to that point, as a teenager going through high school, most of the friends that I had, I chose friends basically based on the things that we liked or the things that we did that were the same. It was all affinity based. So all I had, my friends were friends that I played sports with, that I shared similar interests with. But actually getting to know this group of people made me realize that, you know what? The friends that I had had up to that point, I realized I didn't actually know them very well, and they didn't know me very well because we didn't really interact with one another outside of kind of the interests that we shared. But this group seemed to really know each other. They weren't like one another at all. They didn't have necessarily a lot of shared interests, but they were connected. They knew one another and they loved one another. And frankly, all of this together just kind of made me want to be with these people more. Want to hang out, be in the same space, share time with them. Not just that, but be like them. because they were like alive. There was something compelling about how this community did life together. They had fun. They had this connection to Jesus that I wanted to understand more of. And they didn't just talk about this stuff, but they actually lived it out. They had a lot of things about them that the more I got to know them, the more I wanted those things to be true about me too. I say all this just to make a simple point. Is this. My experience of church at this point now had become radically different than my experience of church growing up. And it was so different that it was changing me. It was changing me. So much so that actually that conversation with the old lady when I was 18 years old eventually became true, but it became true because of this experience of being in a community of people that were so on fire for Jesus. Now, whether you've had an experience like that or not, it was an experience that taught me something. And even as I say this thing, you might think, well, that's a very obvious thing. But even if it is obvious, it's no less significant. It's this. The people you spend the most time with will have a massive impact on what you think about God. The people you spend the most time with will have a massive impact on what you think about God. And for better or for worse, whether they're church people or not church people, whether they're people of faith or not people of faith, whether they're a good influence on you or a bad influence on you, whether they actually point you to God or away from God, and by the way, like none of those statements or groups of people are necessarily even related to each other, the people that we spend the most time with will have a massive impact on what we think about God. So why am I saying all of this? Well, we're in the middle of a teaching series that we are calling the Well DNA. And over the course of this month, we're actually diving into the unique identity that we believe strongly that God has given us as a church and He's called us to be and to live out. And I tell you this story because for me at least, it is one of the most powerful and transforming experiences that kind of points or demonstrates one of the core values that we have as a church. It's a really important part of our own church DNA. And here's what it is. We're better together. We're better together. If you've been part of our church for any period of time, you have probably heard that phrase said in one place or another, maybe up front, maybe by one of our pastors, our leaders. But friends, it's so much more than just kind of a phrase that sounds nice or a cliche or a thing that we say regularly. No, it is actually something we say because we value it. And the reason we value it is because it describes a dynamic that really does have the power to change us. It describes this kind of relational soil that I think most of the time, probably most of us are not super intentional in trying to cultivate. Maybe there's some of us, maybe even many of us, that haven't actually had many experiences of this kind of relational soil in their community. Maybe many of us don't even think about how important it is. We might think, well, maybe it's a good thing if it happens, but you can't necessarily control whether it happens or not. And certainly we wouldn't necessarily consider it an essential thing, a thing that we need in order to grow. What I'm talking about here, friends, is what many of the writers in Scripture actually have a word for. In the Old Testament, in the Hebrew language, that was the language that most of the books of the Old Testament were written in, the word that they used for this is called hesed. Hesed in Hebrew. And it's kind of a difficult word to translate word for word in English. So rather than me trying to stumble my way through trying to explain this to you, I want you to watch this video from the Bible Project that explains exactly what this is.
If you tried to describe what God is like, it could be difficult or daunting. But when the people who wrote the Bible pondered the mystery of God, they consistently described God's character in this way: compassionate and gracious, slow to anger, overflowing with loyal love and faithfulness. We're going to look at this fourth phrase, loyal love. It translates the Hebrew word chesed, which is hard to translate into any language because it combines the ideas of love, generosity, and enduring commitment all into one. Chesed describes an act of promise-keeping loyalty that is motivated by deep personal care. Like in the story of Ruth. Ruth is a foreigner married to an Israelite man, but tragically, her husband dies along with his brother and his father. All Ruth has left is her widowed mother-in-law, Naomi, who has nothing to give her. Naomi tells Ruth she should go back to her people, but instead, Ruth promises to stay by Naomi's side and take care of her. And as other people watch Ruth keep this promise over time, they call it an act of chesed. Notice that Ruth's chesed is not conditional or based on Naomi's worth. Rather, it's an expression of Ruth's character. She just is a generous and loving person who keeps her word. That's chesed. Now, Ruth's loyal love is truly inspiring, but the one who shows the most enduring chesed in the Bible is God. Like in the story about Jacob, who is a treacherous liar even to his own family. But despite that, God chooses him and repeats the promise he made to Jacob's grandfather, Abraham, that he would have a huge family through whom God would restore his blessing to the nations. And so 20 years later, when Jacob realizes how undeserving he is, he says to God, "I'm not worthy of all the chesed you've shown me." And he's right. But God's chesed was never about Jacob's worth in the first place. It's a display of God's generous loyalty to his promise. God's chesed continues into the story of Jacob's descendants, the Israelites. When they're enslaved by Pharaoh in Egypt, we're told that God remembered his promise to Abraham and Jacob. So God defeats Egypt and raises up Moses to liberate the people and lead them into the promised land. And in the story, this is called an act of chesed because it was about God keeping his word. Now, on their way to the promised land, the Israelites are scared of the nations around them and they doubt that God can protect them. So the people threaten to kill Moses and appoint a new leader to take them back to Egypt. God is understandably hurt and angry, but Moses steps in and says, "Forgive the sin of these people because of your great chesed." Notice that Moses asks God to forgive not because the people deserve it, but because it's consistent with God's own character. And God agrees, and he recommits himself to a people that don't want to be committed to him. In the Bible, God is loyal and loving for no other reason than it's just who God is. Of course, he wants his people to respond with chesed in return, but even when they don't, God's chesed remains. The prophet Hosea compared Israel's chesed to a morning mist that's here one moment and gone the next. But God's chesed is enduring. Like in the celebration of Psalm 136 that opens by saying, "Give thanks to the Lord, for he is good," and then 26 times repeats, "His chesed is forever." And so, after centuries of Israel betraying their commitment to God, and after humanity's long history of violence and death, God still kept his promise in a dramatic and drastic way by becoming human and binding himself to us in the person of Jesus. And the people who followed Jesus of Nazareth said that in him they encountered the God of Israel, who is full of loyal love and faithfulness. Jesus is the ultimate loyal and loving human. And in his life, death, and resurrection, God opened up a new future for all of us and for all of creation. And God did this because it's just who God is: generous, loving, and eternally loyal to his promises. And when we experience the purity and power of God's loyal love shown through Jesus, it compels us to reimagine why and how we can show chesed back to God and to the people around us. This is what it means to say that God is overflowing with loyal love.
I love how this video describes what chesed is. I love some of the phrases they use where they say, it combines the ideas of love, generosity, and enduring commitment all into one. This promise-keeping loyalty of God that's motivated by his deep personal care. Love that. Like I said, it's kind of a difficult word to translate one for one, but many of the ways that English translations put this word into the scriptures is phrases like great love, loving kindness, faithful love. It's this deep connection and bond, a kind of loyal care and well-being for another. This is the kind of love that God has for us. But as the video said, it's not just the kind of love that God has for us. It's the kind of love that we are meant to both experience from him, but then share with one another. And more than that, it's the kind of love that literally has the power to change us, to transform us. Several months ago, I read this really interesting book, at least for me, by a couple of guys, one named Jim Wilder, another Michael Hendricks, and it was called The Other Half of Church. Without going into too much detail about what the book is all about, Jim Wilder, one of the authors, he has a master's degree in theology and he has a PhD in clinical psychology. And so he calls himself a neurotheologian. And all that to say is he's just passionate about exploring the connections between brain science and between theology, between the ways that God has kind of created our brains to work biologically, physiologically, and how that lines up with actually some of the ways that Scripture describes what we need to change and grow. It's super cool, at least in my mind. Here's the thing. Wilder says that this hesed love that the Scripture describes, God's faithful and committed love for us, it's even a kind of love that neuroscience would say is one of the most powerfully formative dynamics in all of human development, and for better or worse, which means if we experience it, we develop into relatively healthy, well-adapted, resilient, well-grounded people if we experience it. If we don't, if we lack it in our lives, there can be all kinds of harmful impact on our development. It's the idea or the concept of, in the world of psychology and neuroscience, they call attachment. And whether or not that is a great name for this or not, it's actually just the scientific world's attempt to try to get at a concept or an idea that comes straight from the heart of God and His design for human flourishing. It is all over the pages of Scripture, Old Testament and New. It's this idea that our lives can actually be secure in the stable, unchanging love and commitment of another. That is what actually creates the soil, the environment, the space for us as human beings to grow and develop in a healthy way. Without strong relational attachments, the soil of our soul, it remains depleted of this nutrient that's essential for us to grow as human beings. With it, it actually creates this beautiful environment to grow. And brain science is showing that actually our identity, who we even consider ourselves to be, our sense of self, in fact, develops not just as islands, as individuals, it develops through these attachments, through these relational connections, even from the earliest stages of life. So listen to what Hendricks and Wilder say. They say, infant brains develop identity through joyful interactions, usually with the mother and the father. The joyful faces of the parents are combined with the baby's growing sense of self to form a triad of joyful interaction. In this ideal environment, joy becomes the baby's strength, and this lays a foundation for a lifelong joyful identity. If the parents' faces are fearful during this stage of the baby's growth, or if the parents are detached, the baby's identity does not develop from a foundation of joy and love. In this relational soil, the identity of the infant becomes unstable and disorganized. And then I love what they say. Isn't it like God to design a brain that only knows itself in relationship, and then only when that relationship is one of love? I love that. Isn't it like God to be like that, to be so relational in how we are formed, wired, even from the biological and physiological parts of who we are? And I would say this. That's obviously the ideal of what our biological, our families of origin actually become for us. But whether or not that's something you've experienced from your family of origin, the whole point is we've actually been given a new family in Jesus. Again, here's what Wilder and Hendricks say. Jesus actually intends his church to function as a family that's bonded together with joyful attachments of love. Like a baby with his two smiling parents, our churches can create environments for developing our joyful identities as children of God. When we live in a family of joyful, hesed relationships, we put our brains into the ideal zone for developing us into the image of Christ. We're filled with joy. We're surrounded with stable, deep attachments. Our prefrontal cortex is energized to build a stable identity. When our churches or communities have fear-based attachments to each other and to God, well, this actually creates a chaotic environment for growth. If attachments are weak or transitory instead of secure, development will be stunted. The neurological circuits that Jesus designed to build us into his image are actually running on empty. The soil is depleted. So why do we say we're better together? Why do we say that? Because what all this means is, friends, listen. We become like the ones we are closest to. We become like the ones we are connected to. It is certainly possible for us to change on an individual basis, right? We can all change by learning certain new things, gaining more information, learning certain biblical truths, and then putting them into practice in our lives. Many of us have that kind of experience. But the reality is, actually, half of our brains, the entire right side of our brain, is wired to process things not in terms of words and statements, those things that we can figure out on our own or gain intellectual knowledge for. No, but it's actually wired, hardwired, to process things in terms of relationships and images. Relationships and images. Here's what that means. It means that when we see someone that we trust and we love live or act in a certain way, it actually teaches our brain to value it and imitate it. I think that's fascinating. But if I think about my own life, I can think of all kinds of examples where that's actually true. Let me give you one. It's always stuck with me. Many years ago, when I was in seminary learning to become a pastor, I was interning at a church in Milton called Southside Community Church. And we got there and I met with one of the elders of the church, who was this really just kind, gracious, generous guy. And he spent like a whole afternoon with me, kind of taking me around the church. Then we got in his car and he drove me around town to kind of give me a tour of the town. And while we were driving, I remember clear as day that at every single stop sign in town, he stopped so slowly and then he just waited. It was like he was not in a hurry at all. If there was someone walking, he would have let them go first. If there was another car on one of the other parts of the intersection, he would let them go first, happily wave them on. And I just remember thinking, wow, this guy's patient. I am not nearly as patient as this guy. And I didn't even know him very well at that point. But it was someone I was spending some time with who clearly was a trustworthy person. I will tell you this, even to this day, like more than 20 years later, almost every time I stop at a stop sign, that memory still comes to mind. Whether or not I follow his example, maybe not always, but that memory, almost every time I stop at a stop sign, that memory comes to mind. That person comes to mind. His example comes to mind. Friends, there is transformative power in watching the example of those who are more mature than me, who I spend time with, and especially those who I know love me. And you know what? Jesus knew that too. He did. We've got many examples of that, but I think one of the most beautiful examples that we have is actually, you know, after he had spent about 3 years with some of his closest friends, living, eating, spending time, having them see all kinds of things that he was doing, and shortly before he was about to go to the cross, he had a meal with them, and then he took time to get down on his knees and wash each one of his disciples' feet. It was this, in our context, maybe a little bit weird, in their context, it was this beautiful demonstration of humble servanthood. And then after he did that, Jesus said to them, "You call me teacher and Lord, and rightly so, for that's what I am. Now that I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you should also wash one another's feet. I've set you an example that you should do as I have done for you." And see, Jesus talked to them. He helped them understand what it was that he was doing, but he didn't just talk about it. He didn't just say, "Hey, listen, there's something I want you to know and something I want you to do." He modeled it. He gave them a relational picture of the kind of life that he wanted them to live. And he did it first. Jesus knew. We become like the ones we're closest to. We just do. And I think one of the tragedies in all of this for many of us is that just like most of us don't have a super hard time wrapping our heads around the idea that God loves us. Probably if you're in this room, if you're in church, maybe most of us anyways, probably here would say, yeah, I can agree with the idea that God loves me. But I would say it's probably a very different question. I would think there would be many of us in this room that are a lot less likely to say, you know what, I feel God's love. I experience God's love on a regular basis. I think that's probably something that many of us actually struggle with. And there's probably a lot of us in this room as well that would say, you know what, I don't always necessarily or regularly experience or feel that kind of love from others in my church community either. I think that's tragic. I think it's tragic. And I think there's a lot of reasons for this. I'm not saying these reasons because to sort of make excuses for it, but I think we need to be honest with some of this conversation. And I think the not the one of the reasons is just the fact that it's the cultural air that we breathe. It just is. We live in a culture full of all kinds of sort of individualism and self-reliance. In fact, those are things that we wouldn't just say it's part of our culture. It's a deep value of our culture. Individualism and self-reliance. It is a value that we all live in, whether we are aware of that or not, whether that is something that we do intentionally or not. It's just part of the air we breathe. But I think there's all kinds of other reasons for it, not least of which is that this kind of way of connecting with others, with a closeness, a connectedness, a faithful love in relationships, one of the reasons we struggle with it is because on the one hand, we know better together is good, but we also know that better together is hard. It's just hard. Better together is hard. Loving commitments to others require a lot of time, energy, sacrifice all along the way. It is hard to give up other things in order to commit to some of the important relationships in our lives. That's hard. We've got to at times give up our time, our energy, our resources, our money. That's not easy to do. It is hard to to accept others and to welcome others into my life, especially if they have some deep character flaws, things about them that bother me, or things, the ways that they act toward me that aren't always as loving or as kind or as good as it could be or as it should be. That's hard. It's hard to forgive others when they let me down, when they disappoint me, when they don't necessarily meet some of my needs or my expectations or my hopes for that relationship. Or maybe they just flat out hurt me. Forgiveness is hard, isn't it? And it's hard to lose others. It's hard to lose others. Maybe people that we've grown attached to, and maybe we've lost them because they've moved away, or maybe they've needed to step away because of certain life circumstance, or maybe they've passed away. All of that is hard. Listen to what C.S. Lewis says about all of this in his book, The Four Loves. He says, to love at all is to be vulnerable. Love anything and your heart will certainly be wrung and possibly be broken. If you want to make sure of keeping it intact, you must give your heart to no one, not even to an animal. Wrap it carefully round with hobbies and little luxuries. Avoid all entanglements. Lock it up safe in the casket or coffin of your selfishness. But in that casket, safe, dark, motionless, airless, it will change. It will not be broken, but it will become unbreakable, impenetrable, irredeemable. I mean, that's the risk. It is hard. This is not natural for us. It is not the air we breathe, and it is incredibly difficult. But man, it's worth it. I want to just spend the last few minutes with you kind of talking about, okay, if it is worth it, if it's true that we really are better together, how can we just take a few steps to actually put this more meaningfully into practice? Okay, I think there's all kinds of ways. There's all kinds of ways. I'm just gonna get you started here. And I think for starters, before we even just talk about any of the practicalities of that, and I wanna get into that, I just think one of the ways we can actually change how we approach this is how we think about this. We need to be thinking about our relationships and the way we relate to one another in community, not just as a nice to have or whatever. It is a true, legitimate spiritual practice. It is as important in our lives with Christ as reading our Bibles, as praying, as attending church. It's not just another one of those sort of check boxes or whatever. This is actually a practice that has the power to change us. And more than that, it's a practice that creates a kind of soil in our lives and in our community life that allows all of those other practices to literally become more effective. And as we do, I think there's all kinds of ways we can build on this Hesed, better together community, in how we connect with one another. And I just want to start by giving a few suggestions of how each one of us, wherever you might be at in connection to our church community and even in your spiritual journey, how each one of us might be able to like take a step even within some of the very foundational rhythms and ways of connection that we have as a church. So I'm not trying to like throw a whole bunch of extra to-dos or have-tos on you, but like even within the ways that we already have built into how we relate to as a church, how can we take some next steps in that? Several months ago, we did a teaching series here that we called Healthy Relationships, and Vijay spoke 1 week on building healthy friendships, and one of the things he talked about was these two dynamics of proximity and vulnerability. I want to double down on that and say, like, what does it look like for us to take steps of both proximity and vulnerability within some of the rhythms that we already have as a church? Here's the first, okay? Ready for it? Commit to showing up. Commit to showing up, like regularly attending church and home group. This is why we have these things, okay? It's not just a box like, okay, good, I go to church every week. It's not just a box to check off. No, it's actually meant to be relational space, space and time for you to connect with God, but also with other people who are seeking to connect with Him too. And the times that we have together, when we show up, it actually creates space that can change us. Listen to this. An article I read a while ago by a guy named Carl Vader. He runs an organization that resources and equips like small churches. Here's what he said. 30 years ago, the average fully committed church member attended 3 times a week. 3 times a week. 20 years ago, that dropped down to about 3 times a month. 10 years ago, it was 2 a month. Now, according to churchanswers.com, one source, there's strong anecdotal evidence suggesting that the once a month attender is the fastest growing segment of church life. Also, today, if a church averages 75 in like weekly Sunday morning attendance, you're probably pastoring about 130 to 150 people. Okay, friends, I'm not saying this, certainly not saying this to put a guilt trip on anyone. And I'm not saying it so that you'll just show up to church as if it's something to like check off as like, okay, well, now you're a good churchgoer. No, as a pastoral team, we talk about this kind of stuff regularly and it breaks our hearts. Like we do not miss the irony when people come to us and they talk to us and they're like, if they're not complaining, they're sort of like, they're looking for help to solve a need. When they say to us, you know, I've been coming to this church for a while, but I still don't feel very connected. I don't feel like I've been able to get to know people very well. But then when we begin to ask some questions, it turns out that they've never been part of a home group and they only come to church about 50% of the time. That breaks our hearts. It's like the answer seems to be like right there. Like it actually requires the practice of showing up and showing up regularly. Or when people say to us, you know what? Like my young adult children, they've walked away from God. But then when we begin to ask questions, it turns out that actually over the course of their growing up years, they actually spent a lot more time with their rep softball team and at the cottage and in other places rather than cultivating meaningful relationships within their spiritual community. And then it's a wonder why their own children have walked away from it. Actually, their experience hasn't been one where this has been any meaningful role in their lives, simply because, not because they've checked off the box of showing up to church each week. They've made the community a priority. And showing up is one of the ways that we do that. We cannot build committed relationships, and those are the only kind of relationships that really have the power to change us, if we're not showing up regularly. We just can't. If you get this, if you just committed to showing up regularly to church and to home group, and again, like showing up meaningfully, right? Like to relate and to connect with people, it would give you 75 opportunities a year, every single year, to build relationships with people. And friends, I'm going to guess there are at least some people in this room with you right now that you like. And even more than that, I'm going to guess that there's probably a number of people in this room that you want to be a little more like. Well, that takes showing up. Why would we sell ourselves short of that? Another practice, not just show up, but again, this is about the quality of our relationships and the posture that we take when we show up. I want to encourage you to build into the practice when you come together in community like this, on our Sunday celebration service, at home group, other times that we connect as a church family, build into your habits the practice of lingering, Don't book your schedule so tight that you need to rush off to the next thing at the end of the church service or at the end of home group. Like, build it into your rhythms to be able to be unhurried, to be able to have unplanned conversations and connections with people, to be able to go and chat with someone maybe that you haven't met before or who's new, to pray with someone, maybe someone that you're aware of that has some needs. Well, to build in the time to be able to go before or after our gathering to pray. Don't hurry off to the next thing, because it's actually oftentimes in those unplanned, unexpected moments and conversations, it's in the lingering that we can often have very formative experiences, transformative connections and conversations. Build it into your rhythms, the practice of not just showing up, but of lingering. Here's another one. Party. Let's party, friends. This is actually one of the big reasons why we do home group parties. And I'm going to be honest with you. I've heard rumblings that there are at least, I have no idea who it is. So again, I'm not pointing fingers. We can laugh a little bit about this. But I've heard rumblings that there are some people anyways that actually never show up to home group on their party nights. I think because they don't consider it spiritual enough. I think that's why. No, friends, I couldn't be farther from the truth. Partying as people on the spiritual journey is a deep spiritual practice. Having experiences together where we're having fun, where we're laughing, where we're cultivating joy and commitment with one another. This is the stuff that actually creates a relational soil for all of the other beautiful spiritual ways that we do connect with one another to be planted deeply. We're building, trusting, knowing relationships with one another. We want to be in each other's company. Why? Because it's in that process that we grow and we change with one another. Don't miss out on the opportunities to party. And as part of that, share food together, eat together, share meals. So much of what Jesus did, so much of the meaningful, transformative ministry that Jesus did was over the dinner table. He had so many conversations that literally trans people's lives over the dinner table. Some of the religious people said it wasn't religious or spiritual enough. Jesus knew better. We become like those we regularly eat with. Literally, friends, we really do. It's stuff that doesn't just like nourish our bodies. Our souls, our characters become changed through that. These are all kinds of ways, even within the practices that we have as a church, that you can cultivate. You and I can cultivate proximity. We can practice this idea, this reality of being better together. But it's not just proximity. There's also the reality or the need for us to be vulnerable. Vulnerability. That's another really significant practice, and it's one that is also hard. It's not easy to do, but it has the power to both connect and strengthen our relationships, but change and transform each one of us too. Because here's the thing. When we feel both vulnerable and safe with someone else, that is a powerful dynamic. That's actually an environment that changes us. Listen to what Tim Keller said once. He said, to be loved but not known is comforting. Like, that's nice. If someone loves me but they don't really know me. It's comforting but superficial. To be known but not loved, well, that's our greatest fear, right? Like, if someone really knew me, then maybe they wouldn't want to love me. They would want to walk away. They would want to leave the relationship. Well, that's our greatest fear, to be known but not loved. But to be fully known and truly loved, that's a lot like being loved by God. Oh, I love that. And it's true, because you know what? That's exactly what Jesus has done for us. He knows us. He knows every part of us. He knows all the best parts, all the beautiful parts of us, but he also knows all the worst parts of us, all of the broken parts of us, all of the things that we've done that we haven't done, the things that we regret, the things that we wish we hadn't done that hadn't been part of our story. He knows every single part of it. And all of those parts that we wish were done away with, he's actually done just that. He's like taken them on himself. That's what he did when he died and he rose again. And then he's continued to like say, I'm not going to leave you. No, I'm going to give you my spirit to continue to be in you and walk with you and lead you into like a healing, transforming journey that I will never leave you in. There is something about all of that, friends, that's just not just beautiful for us as we come to know and experience more of Jesus in our lives. It's something we're actually meant to experience in community with one another. Why? Well, because as the scriptures call us, we are the body of Christ. We are the physical demonstration, manifestation of his body here on earth. And the way, one of the most powerful and primary ways we are meant to come to know and understand and experience the love of God is through his people, through one another. And when we can share weakness, when we can share weakness and experience someone not running away but continuing to be faithful to me through that, that is a powerful thing. It changes us, but it's also a very hard thing to do because we just live in a world that is like built around strengths. This is what we do. We celebrate excellence in schools, in sports, in our workplaces. We are drawn to excellent, charismatic leaders. It feels really good when our strengths are kind of noticed, our successes are celebrated, all that kind of stuff. Listen again to Wilder and Hendricks, what they say. Concealed weakness leads to shallow hesed, both with God and with others. In a high hesed community, everyone can share the difficult and vulnerable areas of their lives. We all have parts of our lives that we would prefer to keep in the dark. Yeah, we do, don't we? things that are hard to talk about, hard to see, hard to bring to light. But being honest and open about our weaknesses is part of transformation. Unlike our culture, which attaches around strengths, we as followers of Jesus can attach around our weaknesses as well. Friends, this is a language that all of us need to learn more. Most of us are not fluent in the language of weakness. We need to learn that language. We are much better. We are all much better about talking about the things that we know, the things that we do, the things that we have. But I will tell you this. This is one of the biggest reasons that we call our home groups and not Bible studies. Because frankly, it's too easy. It's too easy to gather around the Bible, to open up its pages and to talk about maybe the things that I already know that I learned 5 or 10 years ago about it, or the things that maybe I'm learning now that I'm noticing now, the great observations that I'm making about it, all of the insights and the new things, and we can have a great stimulating intellectual conversation about it. It's very easy to talk about the things we're noticing in the Bible. It's a lot harder to have an open conversation about what the Bible is noticing in me. In me. Where it's putting a finger on some of the things in me that are maybe hard to admit, hard to talk about, hard to deal with. If that was a language we could all learn to speak better, I will tell you, it would open up whole new doors, both to our friendships and our connections, our relationships in this community. It would make those relationships so much deeper and more loving, but it would also open up whole new doors to transformation and change in our parts. We need to learn to give access to both God and other people to those things in our lives which are maybe difficult to talk about, hard to admit, but we need to. Why? Because we need to change, and the only way to do that is by bringing that stuff to the surface so we can be changed. We need to learn to become more fluent in the language of weakness, in the language of vulnerability. This is something that we can all practice. This is why we do home groups the way we do. You can take a step in that. Every one of us can in the year ahead. Friends, proximity and vulnerability. Both of those things are so hard to do. They're so hard to do. But I know, I just so believe that it is worth the effort, as imperfectly as we all make, to continue to not give up on these things. Why? Because these are the things that really do make us better together. They are the things that make us better together. They are the things that make our relationships better, like less shallow, less routine, more full, more loving. They make our relationships, our community life better and more full. But they're also better because these are the kinds of relationships that make us better, like as people. If we can really take steps to relate to one another, to live life together like this, as imperfect as it is, as hard as it is, none of us are going to do this perfectly. But if we can take steps to grow, I'm telling you, that's better by far. It's the better thing I want for me, and it's the better thing I want for you.